The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
3 minutes to give his talk, and I'll leave it at that.
Great. Thanks everybody for coming out so early. So I'm going to talk about socialism from below. I'm a socialist from below. And when the word socialism today obviously has a lot of connotations, and for once, this talk or a talk similar to this in previous years may have had very different reference points than right now, because for once, when you say socialism right now, what comes to mind immediately is not necessarily kind of visions of other societies or the past, but rather Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and the victory of her congressional campaign, and then the rising socialist movement in the United States today. And that is kind of a new starting point for us to think through some of these questions with this kind of emergence of a new socialist movement, essentially, in this country that's growing. You see people out on the streets demanding the abolishment of a federal agency, ICE. You see all kinds of people getting radicalized around a number of different issues, political issues, and then drawing conclusions from that they need to be organized socialists. And so for today, one of the things that I want to do is like look at this moment as full of possibilities and not yet quite determined. And what we take from this moment and what we can, the path that we're able to chart out of this moment matters for the future strength of this movement, of the kind of socialist movement that we're trying to build. The way that, for example, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez or Bernie Sanders will often talk about socialism, and a lot of the people who are becoming radicalized anew, from the moment that Bernie Sanders got on Saturday Night Live a couple of years ago and said what he was, it's always in terms of like democratic socialism. And I think one of the things that's meant by this, by most people, is just a basic and shared, deep felt desire that we all have for a world without poverty, without environmental devastation, and war. And it represents a striving at a very elemental level for more democracy, for more solidarity, and for more equality. And it's just like a basic, healthy political instinct. At a certain point, though, and this is kind of what I want to get into in this talk, we're going to have to ask ourselves and confront the question of what kind of world we're fighting for. And so when pressed for proof that this kind of a world is feasible, that this kind of world works, people like Bernie Sanders will point towards, as a model of socialism, will point towards like Sweden or the social democracies of Western Europe as a kind of like functioning model of socialism. And for people today who look at those societies, they look a lot better than what we have here. For people in Western Europe who've lived through the last 40 years of austerity, maybe not so much, and that's why there's protests out and opposition parties in Europe today, just as much as in the United States. And so for people even there, or other people who are not quite satisfied with that kind of a model, the only other real alternative that you have in history are the kind of Stalinist anti-worker dictatorships of the Eastern Bloc. And I think that pretty much the new wave of socialists coming are confronting the real question of like how could gulags and cults of personalities and show trials have anything to do with democracy or the basic striving for more solidarity and equality that we're all fighting for. That's a real contradiction, and I don't think that you have to support dictators to be a socialist. Strangely, that needs to be said. But I think these are the kinds of questions of like, what are we actually going towards? What is the world that we're fighting for that we need to start having more of an in-depth answer to? And so that's really what I'm going to try to get into in this talk. The future of this kind of new generation of socialists, I think, is largely undefined. And one possible outcome of where this goes is a repeat of these so-called socialisms of the 20th century. Whether Stalinist Russia or the kind of fossilized and neoliberal social democracies of Western Europe. Both of these I will characterize as socialism from above. But there's another path. a kind of specter haunting the resurgence of interest in socialism in 2018. And that alternative is socialism from below. It's a world based on workers' control and complete democracy. And that's where I want to start, because when the socialist movement began in the 19th century, it focused on workers. And that's kind of the starting point of, I think, what I want to get into. So when we talk about a world controlled by ordinary people, democratic control over our economy and our lives, ordinary people that we're talking about are, as socialists, we're talking about workers, people who work for a living, who sell their labor, who have to go to a job for somebody else, which is the vast majority of society. And to be clear, I'm not just talking about the white male industrial workers, but the real working class in all of its multiracial, transnational, gender-ending splendor. As individuals, workers are pretty powerless. They depend upon their boss for their jobs and their livelihoods. If they speak out against injustice, they risk retaliation or losing their job, or on a protest, they risk being picked off by the police. But collectively, the boss depends upon workers. The schools and the hospitals and the coffee shops would not run if it weren't for a collective mass of workers. And that's why strikes, when workers refuse to work, are so categorically powerful. They force the hand of bosses and what we normally consider very powerful individuals. They shut down a whole system and show who really makes things run. That power, the collective powers of workers under capitalism, is the concrete reality upon which socialists since Marx have based their hope, not just to reform capitalism, but to build a different kind of society altogether. The point is not that working people are more radical. In fact, workers can be just as sexist, racist, or reactionary as anybody else. But the point is that capitalist society is built upon an antagonism. A tiny group of people have pieces of paper saying that they own the schools, the factories, the warehouses, and the hospitals. These are capitalists, and they depend for their own continued existence upon the profit that they make off the people that they employ. So it's not a choice, it's not greed, it's their very reproduction in society depends upon making profit off of other people. Profit for them supersedes everything, including human rights like healthcare, education, and even democracy. Workers do have an interest in those things, in a better life, or at least a livable life, as most people have seen, like workers have, things are shitty and we want a better life. And like that is a basic fundamental striving of the vast majority of people in our society. Workers are also the only group in society with the potential power to end the reign of this kind of oligarchy, the tiny 1%, and build a new kind of society that serves everybody. The premise of socialism is pretty simple. Full democracy. It's the complete democratization of society. As Karl Marx and then Hal Draper put it. Meaning every person has the right to decide over the conditions of their own life, and working people collectively have the decision-making power over how society is run. Capitalism is incompatible with that kind of a democracy. Even narrow political democracy under capitalism is a sham, where we get to cast our vote once every couple of years for some representative to misrepresent us. But more importantly, and this is the kind of point that socialists have always emphasized, as soon as you enter the workplace under capitalism, you exit the realm of democracy. You have no say over how things are produced, what gets prioritized, or how things are distributed in your workplace, and of course, in the economy as a whole. You effectively enter a dictatorship of the boss for 50 plus hours a week, and the economy as a whole could be considered a dictatorship of the market. Democratize the workplace and the economy, and you can organize it based upon human needs like healthcare, education, and more free time. So that's what socialism meant for Marx and the early kind of socialist or communist movement, this kind of complete democratization of society. Until partway through the 20th century, it was generally taken for granted that Marxism stood for that kind of revolutionary workers' democracy. But the last century of left politics internationally has done a number on the terms that we've been forced to think through as socialists and as the left. And that's kind of where this distinction comes through, socialism from above or socialism from below. If we're serious about forging a path to a better world, we have to understand how socialist society can work. And understanding that starts with looking at how so-called socialist states of the Soviet Union and Western Europe did not fulfill the socialist mission, indeed functioned to suppress workers' power. And so I want to start with Stalinism, or the kind of system that came to be throughout most of the 20th century in Russia or in the Eastern Bloc, in the Soviet Union. Firstly, Stalin's Russia is what Fox News will point to when they talk about socialism, of course. The food lines, the gulags, the travel restrictions, the slave labor, etc. This society was built up on the conception that socialism has something to do with state ownership of the economy. The idea here, and this is, I'm going to give the best representation of this idea that I can. The idea is that if you nationalize all the sectors of the economy, the state can then run the economy according to a plan and theoretically distribute things more equitably according to different priorities than individual greed, which is the driving kind of force in capitalism, the theory goes. That is the best possible interpretation of the idea behind this kind of statist socialism. The problem with this is the following. If the state controls the economy, who controls the state? In the Eastern Bloc, the state was controlled not by ordinary working people, but by a one-party dictatorship of state functionaries. In the Soviet Union, this party itself expressed the interests of a new class of bureaucrats with certain privileges, access, and standards of living that was far superior to the mass of ordinary working people. While workers who actually went to work every day and produced the wealth of the country had an inherent interest, like we today, in collective solidarity and democratic control, the interests of this bureaucratic class were tied to the expansion and the power of the state over workers. The mere fact that the economy is owned by the centralized state doesn't prevent the class controlling that state from using all those resources for their own benefit, very much like the state in capitalist West is used to protect and further the interests of private capitalists. The protection of the bureaucrats' interests often meant that the state was used against working class movements and working class interests. Instead of a society built around fulfilling human needs were sacrificed for the sake of military buildup and expanding production quotas. Many people today who identify themselves with this sort of socialism will justify themselves by saying things like this was the only real alternative to capitalism. This was the only way socialism could be enacted. But in the process of apologism, the goalposts have changed. Socialism is no longer defined as workers' power, but rather as the nationalization of the economy on behalf of workers. The assumption is that workers themselves are incapable of running their own society. They need guidance from experts who know better, an elite to administer society as their representatives, because an ordinary plumber or cab driver are too backwards to govern. You need an enlightened group of representatives to build socialism. Socialism in this conception has to be handed down to the grateful masses from above. Workers become the recipients of socialism, consumers of socialism, instead of active agents, producers, and creators of their world. Now I want to move towards the second model of a kind of socialism that has been represented in the 20th century, which is commonly understood as, you know, the social democracies of Western Europe. Even if you don't have Sweden or the countries of Western Europe as your model today, to bring it back to kind of what people are fighting for when they say democratic socialism, this is perhaps more of an intuitive understanding of what we're fighting for. These societies were built upon the idea that socialism has something to do with using the state to regulate the private economy. We could summarize the associated strategy as follows. We start running socialist candidates who are really champions of women, immigrants, workers, and the oppressed into Congress and into elected positions. After you get more and more of these socialist candidates elected, you get a majority in the representative bodies of the state, or even a significant minority. Once you have this, you can then begin to use the state through creating new laws, new programs, funding infrastructure, raising the minimum wage, or even demilitarizing the police. The idea here is that there is immense power in the state, and the way that we are brought up, the state, the capitalist state, the government, is the key shaper of the world that we live in. And so, of course, there's a lot of validity to that. There's no other shaper more powerful than the state. So why not use that power for good, Frodo? So the logic goes. To shape the world in the way that we want to see it. Why not legislate in a more equitable distribution of resources, use state power to rein in the excesses and destructive behaviors of the giant corporations? So I think like this is a real question that we want to take seriously. To approach it in one way, let's say that even if we could instantly change the electoral laws in the United States, abolish the Electoral College, superdelegates, all the crazy stuff that we have here, let's assume that we can run an explicitly socialist party in national elections and replace every single one of the pro-business, pro-capitalist officials in the state. The good-natured socialists in office, and we're taking them as honest, genuine socialists, would still face an ultimate obstacle in trying to introduce socialism into a capitalist economy. As long as we live under capitalism, the state depends for revenue on a growing and healthy capitalist economy. Whether the economy grows depends on if capitalists, the private owners of wealth, decide to invest. If a capitalist doesn't see a favorable business climate that offers potential profits, they won't invest. And overall investment slows down in the economy. Once that happens, economic growth slows down too, meaning employment opportunities start evaporating and general income starts to fall. So tax revenues for the state also shrink. Because capitalists have control over the wealth, they subjectively decide when to invest. That's kind of the premise of the market economy. You can't be forced to invest as a capitalist. The state, regardless of who is in power, is thus compelled to convince the capitalists to invest. And the only ways to do this in capitalism, as long as we're living by the laws of capitalism, is by the creation of a good investment climate, including slashing labor protections, cutting taxes on the rich, privatizing sectors of the economy like healthcare and education, and even defending the interests of capitalists abroad through war and military buildup. Paradoxically, even if the state wants to pay for universal healthcare or free education or the like, the only way it can do that, ultimately, is to raise funds by gutting social protections and catering to the private corporations, whose investment decisions determine the state of the economy as long as private property is the basis for our society. I want to stress that this is not a natural law. This is governed by the rules of the capitalist economy. That's exactly the dilemma that the Social Democratic parties of Germany, France, Sweden, and all of Western Europe ran up against throughout the 20th century. They had to make a choice. Either administer capitalism and neoliberal austerity policies in the interests of capital, or relinquish their posts in the state. In every country, they clung to their positions in the state, even when that meant they had to turn against the workers they were originally there to serve. Because they identified their interests with nation states, the Social Democratic parties of the 20th century have also tended to support the national projects of their countries, including against the workers of other countries through wars, colonialism, and the imposition of debt servitude. Social democracy is characterized by a strategy of using the state under capitalism to try to legislate in socialism on workers' behalf. It is a socialism from above, where socialism becomes something handed down to the constituents by an enlightened group of governing representatives. The problem is that their own positions necessarily come to depend upon the profitability of capital. Because of this, social democracy ultimately leaves the power of capitalists over workers in the workplace untouched. That power of capital is thus allowed to continue shaping and shuttering democracy and human rights throughout society. Both of these socialisms from above share a conception in which socialism must be handed down to the masses by an elite who know how to manage a society. In other words, they share a common hostility to the idea that ordinary people can be trusted to take over society and run it in their own interests, collectively and democratically. Both of them rely upon some substitute for working class self-activity, whether a stratum of elite state planners or a select group of representatives elected to office. Historically, other substitutes for working class self-activity have arisen amongst various movements, calling themselves socialists. These have included peasant armies, utopian communes, conspiratorial groups of coup plotters, guerrilla fighters, or even small groups of intellectuals who proclaim themselves to be the leadership of a non-existent movement. All of these reflect an approach to politics as something workers must have done for them, an approach that has become almost common sense. And I think it's pretty understandable that this kind of thinking is so widespread. Every day we go to work and have no control over the plan, the purpose, or the direction of the workplace. Whether you work at a factory, a hospital, a nonprofit, a school, or a coffee shop, you exit the realm of democracy as soon as you enter the workplace. You're not at work to explore your creative potential. You are there to do what your boss tells you to do and make a profit for them. Anything you create becomes someone else's property. You start to get used to having no say in how things are done, where resources go, or what the priorities are. The most you can hope for is to make suggestions to the real decision makers, your boss. Any change that comes about in how things are run or what gets prioritized necessarily have to come through the boss or the owner. While the workers who do all the work receive new developments or plans as packaged decisions, they are on the receiving end. That's the environment you spend the majority of your waking life inhabiting. It's similar in politics. Changes, we are told, have to happen gradually as a result of long discussions by experts in the halls of power. We can then react positively or negatively to what they come up with. We can vote some out or vote some in, express our disapproval, protest. But at the end of the day, ordinary working people don't have any direct control over the priorities, resource distribution, or laws handed down by governments. But this matter of thinking, politics from above, we could call it, only serves to protect those who currently have power and wealth, to shore up the system of capitalism that keeps the vast majority from exercising any power over their own living conditions. The attempt to emancipate workers from above were not just imperfect, they were inevitably doomed to failure. And between these two, the attempts that I discussed, what has been lost is a kind of insurgent workers' democracy, a revolutionary form of socialism that sees working class power as a creative force in society, the power of whom is to be fostered and developed unconditionally by democratic means, both before and after taking power. Democracy was always supposed to be intrinsic to socialism, and it provides an antidote to the tendencies toward fossilization, bureaucratization, and adaptation to capital. We can only tap into the collective strength and creative potential of workers if it's workers themselves who seize power from below, and that can only be initiated and maintained democratically. This is socialism from below, or what Marx called the self-emancipation of the working class. For a lot of people today, even this kind of a prospect that I just kind of sketched out seems very remote, very distant. The periods of decline in working class activity are conducive to the reemergence of the myth of a savior from on high. When the bosses are winning, these ideas come to dominate among those interested in social change. During periods of mass mobilization and revolution, however, the ideas of self-activity and social change from below spread pretty rapidly, become validated at every turn, and therefore start to crystallize into a new common sense. That's why movements like the revolutionary upsurge of the 1960s, Occupy Wall Street, or the recent wave of teachers' wildcat strikes can shatter years of assumptions and expectations drilled into people during long stretches of defeat and diminishing living standards. Once those seemingly deep-set assumptions and expectations are washed away, our political horizons can expand boundlessly. The possibility of ordinary workers seizing power has been demonstrated time and again throughout history. It happened in the Paris Commune of 1871. The whole working class seized power in Russia in the Russian Revolution of 1917, creating an alternative state based upon their own newfound organizations, workers' councils, or Soviets, the highest form of democracy. In Revolutionary Catalonia of 1936, George Orwell reported on what it looked like for the working class to be in the saddle. I'll quote him. He says, this is him walking through Catalonia in 1936. Practically every building of any size had been seized by the workers and was draped with red flags or with the red and black flag of the anarchists. Every shop and cafe had an inscription saying that it had been collectivized. Even the bootblacks had been collectivized and their boxes painted red and black. Waiters and shopwalkers looked at you in the face and treated you as an equal. Servile and even ceremonial forms of speech had temporarily disappeared. Nobody said senor or don or even usted. Everyone called each other comrade. Tipping was forbidden by law. There were no private motor cars. They had all been commandeered, and all of the trams and taxis and much of the other transport were painted red and black. The revolutionary posters were everywhere, flaming from the walls in clean reds and blues. All this was queer and moving. There was much in it that I did not understand, and in some ways, I did not even like it. but I recognized it immediately as a state of affairs worth fighting for. And I think this kind of flourishing of creativity that happens in any society where workers take power is you can replicate in every single society that this has ever happened. In Russia, a little known example of like viewing the social world that we live under and experience as objective fact and natural law just starts to turn into flux in Russia. So for example, on the coastal cities of Russia in 1917, 1918, where all of the constitutionality was and the state citizenship laws were controlled by the local Soviets, these democratic organs, they changed their definition of citizenship not to be based upon nationality, but rather class. And so all of these families who had lived in Russia for 1,000 years, for hundreds of years at least, who had these, you know, castles and everything, were immediately stripped of their citizenship, their right to vote, etc., while any old immigrant who, like, found a ride on some ship and arrived the day before was given full, complete rights in the workers' democracy, right? Like, that is, I think, an example that illustrates a little bit of what it means to start to see the world in a different way that could be shaped by workers in practice based upon democratic collective decisions. If bottom-up socialism is a world worth fighting for, how do we get there? We're starting with an apparent contradiction here. Socialists believe that workers themselves have the power and the ability to govern their society and count on working class people to fight for that society, socialism. But as we know, most workers are not socialists, meaning most workers don't advocate for working class power. Indeed, many workers have bad ideas. They're homophobic or racist or anti-union. How could workers become convinced that their interests are tied to the rest of their class? Which is multiracial, multigendered, gay, straight, trans, and international. How could workers become confident enough to exercise their strength against the bosses who seek to pit us against each other? We cannot rely on some group of individuals with the right ideas to educate the masses to freedom. The stakes are too high. It's important to understand that socialists alone will not radicalize the whole working class. It's the contradictions of capitalism itself that drive working people to fight back in the first place. Those contradictions are ever present, from the demeaning experiences in the workplace to the unrestrained brutality of politicians like Trump. As our numbers grow, socialists can help strengthen, organize, and hopefully play a role in guiding the elemental movements that will inevitably arise. But to imagine that a relatively small group of socialists could substitute ourselves for these mass movements would be to squander our precious resources and misunderstand what it means to say workers' power. Only the working class as a mass, self-reliant movement can emancipate itself. And as Eugene Debs said, if I could lead you into the promised land, someone else could lead you out again. The best way to shed the deep feelings of isolation and powerlessness which workers are bombarded with every time they go to work is through workers' activity itself. Not the actions of their representatives, but the working class self-activity, primarily strikes and mass movements in the streets. This kind of self-activity pits workers against the bosses and builds confidence in our collective strength as a class. And we saw this even in the recent strike wave in West Virginia, Oklahoma, Arizona, Kentucky, and North Carolina. 3 months ago, I was in the Capitol building in Oklahoma during the first 2 days of the strike there. On the first day, we talked to a lot of teachers, asking them what they thought about the strike, how long they thought it would last, why they were out there. And the answers that we got from people when we asked them these questions were very much like, well, I hope that these representatives understand how important of an issue this is. They're gonna give us some new laws and it'll change. We'll be out here maybe for a few more days. 36 hours later, by the next day, when we were talking to people, after all of the news channels have the strike on them, 500,000 students are out of school, this strike paralyzed the state of Oklahoma during these 36 hours. Everywhere teachers looked, they saw the entire state talking about their strike, talking about this activity. When your kids are out of school, parents have to organize daycare. This is totally dominating every discussion in Oklahoma. And meanwhile, the Republican legislator is totally intransigent, even insulting of the teachers. When we asked teachers 36 hours later what they thought, how long they thought the strike would last, The kind of answers that we saw reflected, I think, a hardening of resolve among a lot of these teachers who had very little experience with working, you know, a mass strike, as most of us don't. The answers we got were, my school called off all week. I'm going to be here all year. I'm going to be here into the summer. I'm no longer a teacher. I'm an activist now. That's what I do. When workers exercise their power like that, any illusions that capitalist legislators will be on your side start to melt away. At the same time that the mass picket line of fellow workers gives you strength and confidence in your power as a class. It's a transformative experience to be on a strike. Every strike, I think, is a microcosm of that. It's kind of a laboratory of changing consciousness in a way that reading a book just can't really compare. For that temporary glimpse of power to become a permanent reality, more than a strike will be necessary. The only way to move from just resisting to taking power is to disrupt and replace the mechanisms of exploitation, the class relationship at the heart of the market economy. Unless you remove capitalists from their position of power over other people, capitalism will always balance itself on the backs of workers. Getting rid of exploitation will take much more than new representative. It will take social and economic revolution. Socialism from below is necessarily a revolutionary socialism. What is revolution? It's not just a single act, smash the state, but an entire perspective of widespread grassroots working class self-activity. It's sailors stripping their superiors of their insignia, or workers hauling off their bosses to the local ravine in a wheelbarrow, as happened on numerous occasions in the Russian Revolution. A revolution is what Trotsky called the forcible entry of the masses onto the stage of history. A revolution is the full process whereby the working class seizes power for itself. And just in terms of the horizons of what we're talking about as well, it's important to know that capitalism is a global force. It has been given rise to a system of geopolitical competition among nation states, each in the service of a national ruling class. Workers don't have any stake in either side of those inter-imperialist rivalries. You don't have to support dictators to be a socialist again, which strangely is what a lot of people will argue today. Some people find themselves joining the fight for a better world for all, for freedom from dictatorship in the workplace, only to find themselves being pressured to support dictators abroad, like Bashar al-Assad, simply because that ruling class has come into conflict with the US ruling class. Capitals compete. That's what capitalism is. Of course they're going to come into conflict. That's a feature of imperialism. You don't have to have any, you don't have any stake in siding with the boss who's trying to undercut your own boss. They're both bosses, and they both belong in the wheelbarrow. Socialism is meaningless if, in the name of anti-imperialism, it tolerates the brutal, genocidal crushings of uprisings from below in other countries. Our aim is for the exploited and oppressed themselves to determine their own future. Those struggles to do so, the struggles from below, are happening in every country in the globe. That's why any socialism worth its salt is an international socialism. Revolutionary and international. That's the horizons of consistent working class self-activity, and of course the perspective of socialism from below. That perspective will inform what we do here and now. And I do want to talk a little bit about how this filters down to what we're doing as socialists today. Fighting for and winning concrete social changes like tuition-free education, universal health care, and unemployment supports right now is central to building a movement that can put power in the hands of workers. If you have a perspective of socialism from below, the most effective way to fight for these kinds of reforms is based upon what will strengthen the fighting capacity and the confidence of the working class in itself. So whereas fighting for a prosecutor, for example, to replace the current prosecutor is not really going to build your confidence in yourself to shape your world. Having an unemployment support that's 90% of your current wage for the next 3 to 5 years means going on strike sounds a lot less daunting. Those are the kinds of things that I'm talking about when I say building the confidence or the fighting capacity of the working class to take power itself, or to self-activity, essentially. Within social movements that arise here and now, there are two key imperatives that flow from a perspective of socialism from below. One, movements have to be mass inclusive struggles. Any successful movement will rely on all of the workers, mass numbers. That's where our strength lies. That also means our movements have to be multiracial, cross gender and national lines. take up and challenge the oppression of each and every member of the working class. That's not a moral imperative. That's the movement's deep well of power. Number two, social movements and workers must rely only upon themselves. A successful movement from below will not try to win the trust of big funders, but instead start to impose costs on them, disrupt their business environments. If change can only come from below, movements cannot rely on professional organizers or NGOs. Socialists should seek to constantly expand any movement or campaign they're in order to draw in more and more people and involve them in the process of their own self-emancipation. Socialism from below is a simple idea, even if all the forces of capitalism are set to distort and undermine it. It is a historically rooted recognition that no one is coming to save us. Workers have to emancipate themselves and build a new society based on their own power. The concept of worker self-emancipation was the unique contribution of Karl Marx, who reached this conclusion in 1845 after witnessing and learning from workers' rebellions of his own time. And a lot of work uncovering this history has been done by Hal Draper, who is a revolutionary socialist from the United States and who's written a number of great books called Karl Marx's Theory of Revolution that I recommend everybody read. His pamphlet is called The Two Souls of Socialism, which is where the phrase socialism from below comes from. Karl Marx famously said very little about what a socialist or a communist society would look like. Of course he didn't. If socialism is the careful implementation of a blueprint thought up by a genius, you will have a set of guidelines and rules about socialism, what socialism will look like. But if you see socialism as a dynamic process of active and creative construction on the part of a whole generation of people discovering their own capacities anew, then only they can say what socialism will look like when the time comes. We view the oppressed and exploited of today as literally the potential rulers of society. Socialism from below will undoubtedly be messy, but it will be a free society. The new rulers, the cooks and the cab drivers, will no longer live under the imperatives of capitalism. In fact, they won't live under any system. They'll live over socialism. That's the point. And it is up to us and the future generations to decide what we will do with the world once we've seized it.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.